We live in a fast-paced and hectic world where it's easy to feel overwhelmed, stressed, and out of control. How do you manage all the competing pressures without losing sense of yourself? How do you stay focused enough to not only plot a path, but follow it? Welcome to Recovery Road, a show that offers inspiration, insight, and intelligence, as well as success stories from many walks of life that can show you how you can control your own destiny. Our knowledgeable and entertaining host and her guests give practical advice that you can use every day in the quest to master your life. Now, here's your host, Leah Mattinson.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's show. I'm host Leah Mattinson, and thank you to each and every one of you from wherever it is that you are on this beautiful planet for tuning into today's episode. I'm very excited to once again welcome back to the show Dr. Howard Rankin. Howard, welcome to the show.
Great to be back with you and all your listeners, Leah. Yeah.
So Howard is a podcaster. His podcast is called I Think, Therefore I Am Wrong. And he's also somebody who's got a lot of, although he might say not a lot, but some experience and background in using adapted neuroscience for in clinical practice. And I wanted to have Howard on today specifically to talk about this recent bombshell that came out about a possible fraudulent images that were being used in key Alzheimer's research, because it was just so upsetting and startling. When I read that headline, I thought we need to talk about this because millions of dollars go into research for Alzheimer's and all kinds of other things. And when we hear or read the news that it could be fraudulent or possibly not even based on something that is real, it throws into question a lot of things like, can we trust the science? Can we trust the people who are being given trillions of dollars to do these kind of research? And what's the implications on families who are living with these very serious illnesses? And so, Howard, thank you for coming to be a guest on the show today to just kind of dive right in and talk about this subject and then the little bit broader subject matter of how do we actually, what do we know about scientific research and how can we use scientific research to our benefit and where is it maybe twisted where things kind of get off the path? How do we become savvy consumers and savvy in creating a masterful life given all this stuff that's going on, the shenanigans and the good stuff?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, let's unpack that.
There's a lot of stuff to cover. Let me just kind of go through the story of where we are today. Two or three years ago, a expert in analyzing brain imagery, a guy called Matthew Schrag, was approached by a lawyer who was representing two clients who were claiming that Cassava Sciences' new drug, Simufilam, was actually not as effective or justified. And they approached him because Schrag was an expert in this. And indeed, he found that in the study, some of the images looked extremely dubious, looked like they'd been photoshopped and what have you. And that then led him ultimately to look at the whole basis of one of the core theories, the core theory in Alzheimer's, which was the buildup of a protein called beta amyloid, or amyloid beta, sometimes either way, amyloid beta that creates plaques, sticky plaques in the brain, and therefore impacts functioning communication within the brain and results in the symptoms that we see. Mm-hmm. And this goes back then to 2006 into the University of Minnesota laboratories run by a well-respected woman called Karen Ash. And she had one of the people working in her lab, a guy called Sylvain Lesny, produce a paper that said that this amyloid beta, you know, clearly shows the plaques and what have you. And so now, you know, 12, 13, 14 years later, Matthew Schrag is going back and looking at these papers and seeing that some of the brain images seem to have been doctored or photoshopped.
Yeah,
you know, which is amazing, really. Yeah. He approached Science Magazine and NIH and various other people, then got to look at his findings and came up with exactly the same thing, that these images looked like they had been photoshopped. Whether they had been or not, they just didn't look legitimate. Mm-hmm. And the thing about that was that this amyloid beta theory has been the core theory about Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and the main research being done on Alzheimer's physiologically has been all around this amyloid theory of these plaques building up and creating this damage. You know, people were looking at how can we neutralize the, you know, the plaques for medicine and so forth. And millions and millions of dollars had been spent on research, which was now questionable.
Yeah, and it's such a kick in the gut. When I read the the headline, it was really this visceral kick in the gut for me, because, of course, with the Huntington's background, I'm very interested in neuroscience and have been following along in many of, like, Parkinson's, ALS, like anything to do with neurology. I'm interested in knowing what it is that the science is doing and what the researchers are doing. And first of all, I want to say how sorry I feel for the people who've been led down this garden path, because it does affect people in their real life. And that I really do feel sorry for that. And that we've had guests on over the past 6 years on this show to talk about, you know, how to take back your health, your brain health. And so I'm thankful and grateful again, also for people who are on the other side of this argument. Or maybe it's not even the other side, but the side of the argument that's saying, how can we actually be healthy in spite of all these things that are going on? So backing up the bus that we've only been talking about it for, you know, 6 years on the podcast, or 7 years on the podcast, but families who've been throwing their heart and soul and showing up at all kinds of fundraisers in every developed nation to help deal with and throw money at research. Again, I just want to say, you're in my thoughts, and I'm asking you just to kind of hold the fort, hold strong through this interview, because there is a bright side to this. Maybe more than one, and that it's like to not throw out the baby with the bathwater, because there are thorns in the lion's paw, as we know in life. Mm-hmm. And so part of my visceral reaction was, oh yes, sons of bitches. I can't even, and the swearing and that, like, I really felt like that. Mm-hmm. And again, because lots of people have been banking on there being a solution, banking on it for their families and banking on it for, yeah. So it's been very, it was very much personal for me. And so again, just to tell people to hang in there while we talk through this a bit more and flesh it out and tease it out, so we can understand, how did this happen? Like, how did one paper become the basis of all of this research? Because this isn't the first time that this kind of shenanigan has happened. But how did that happen? Do you know, Howard? Can you?
Yes. Going back to 2006, I mean, Karen Ash at the University of Minnesota is very well respected. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that obviously people giving significant grants, you know, this is a very well respected, well-run research unit. And so that's one thing. We will definitely give them money. It looks like we're going down, you know, this is something valuable. And I think the lesson here, and I should say that Matthew Schrag himself stops short of saying this is fraudulent. He just says these are red flags about the nature of the research. Mm-hmm. Now, one should also say that the research over the last 15, 16 years has really failed to come up with anything that's effective, mm-hmm. in terms of a treatment. And probably part of the reason is the understanding of plaque and amyloid beta is probably off. Now, it does not mean that amyloid beta does not have a role to play, but the way we researchers have been looking at it, trying to block it and so forth, hasn't produced results. And so it's almost like being back to square one.
Right, which can be a good thing, but
absolutely, yeah. And I think one of the things here that is important, you know, especially for the national institutes who give out so much grant money, is, you know, be careful. Unless there's really compelling, overwhelming evidence, don't put all your eggs in one basket. I mean, that's what happened. I mean, in fact, some people call the amyloid mafia, people who were jumping on this and saying, oh, we could do this research, we could do this research, we could do this research, all around this one theory. Mm-hmm. And that sort of backfired. But at least we've, I think, now got it into a better perspective.
Mm-hmm. And so it's part of the reason for jumping on the bandwagon that there's funds available. So it funds research.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about that. You know, and I was in the early part of my career in a research institution. So I know a little bit about the hassle it was in the UK to, you know, prepare grants, explain everything, you know, do all the stuff and justify what you're doing. So it's a lot of work. But when you have an established laboratory with a well-known leader, obviously that becomes a lot easier. And they are going to get big grants. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to get millions of dollars to do research for the next 3-5 years. Mm-hmm. And we have to think about that. You know, if you have some doubts about a theory, are you going to go public with that? If you're about, you know, you're about to get, you know, your next 5 years' income for your team funded, that puts you in a bit of a moral dilemma. But I should also say, and we perhaps get to this, you know, from my work in cognitive neuroscience, we can convince ourselves as human beings of anything. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I'm sure that you, if you were invested in a particular idea in research, it would be extremely unusual for you to drop it and say, you know what, I've been wrong for the last 10 years. I mean, people just don't do that. Right. I mean, it's really hard to do that. Although I see that Matthew Shrug, looking at some of his work, he had a theory about the relationship between Alzheimer's and iron, and did some research, and it failed to prove anything. And he said so. He said, yeah, didn't work.
Right. And isn't that part of ethics in, like, why people who are in university take ethics classes? I mean, if you're not ethical, if you're not an ethical being after you're a child, children are pretty ethical. But if you're not, you know, they might be savage, but they... Right. That'd be pretty, whatever, but they're not usually unethical.
Yeah, you know, yeah, so. No, true. And I would, I'm just thinking out loud here, I don't know this for sure, but I'm thinking, you know, major agencies, when you talk to them about ethics, what they're thinking about is, okay, we're going to give this to, you know, people with a problem. We got to make sure it's not going to harm them. What are we going to tell people in the placebo group? How is the data going to be used? Those are the ethical issues, you know. But over and above that, the overarching ethical issue is, do you have the courage, if you come up with negative results, to say the results were negative?
Right. Yes.
And that's a problem in research, because negative results don't really get published.
Mm-hmm. That's true. They don't. Not really. Yes.
Right. They don't get published. And therefore, what's out? And that's actually, you know, something that seriously needs to be looked at. Mm-hmm. Because it does need to be published as much as the positive results do, right?
Yes.
You know, you go online and you say, oh, look for amyloid beta, and you come up with all these studies that supposedly are positive, and, you know, a few studies that are negative. There's a great tendency, forget those, there's just a few of those. Well, that's a publishing bias.
Yeah, okay. And so let's talk about that, because, again, it's like the industry, there's an industry that is the publishing and the reading and the supporting of all these journals. You know, we're supposed to, as consumers, or even as, you know, the other scientific, the whole scientific world is supposed to rely on each other's acumen and careful study That's what people go to work in their research labs every day, just to perform repetitive experiments over and over again with the intent of leaving a trail, mm-hmm. you know, leaving a trail for the next person so that the next person can pick up and go, that worked or it didn't work. Or that's what excellent science is actually about.
And so that's also an issue in science, perhaps not one of the issues in science, is that's exactly how it's meant to work. So you do a study, you have a finding. Now, other people in different locations, unconnected with you, do the same study, basically, test out the same hypothesis, and so show what they've found. And when you get enough support for something, then you get on a roll. What's happened here is this somehow gripped the scientific community in this field, and of course the pharmaceutical industry, who are looking, you know, what a bonanza it would be for a pharmaceutical company to come up with a fix, mm-hmm. not necessarily a cure or something that delayed Alzheimer's. Oh my gosh, that would be phenomenal, and I'm sure they're all trying to do that. But then there are issues with that too, because then your main priority is not driven really by research. It's by research that shows you've got a drug that would work, that would justify medication. And we should get into that whole subject of drug trials too, because that's another issue.
Right. Well, let's do that, because part of the thing is that everything is the solution is drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The solution is drugs.
Right.
So that's right. All of the solutions are drugs. And I was reading through this thread that was, people commenting on this original story that I had read about this Alzheimer's thing. And there's lots of comments about, you know, trust the science, and then, you know, the laughy face, and the, you know, about the, a bunch of stuff about the vaccines. And then, you know, way down in the thread, somebody puts this comment about, do you know, if you just clean up your lifestyle that you can actually get rid of Alzheimer's.
Yes.
And then what was funny though, is there was all these comments on the comments on this thread, but that comment had no comments and no thumbs up. No, isn't that interesting? That's telling.
And you know, the two famous neuroscientists that we know and have been on our podcast, Dean and Aisha Sherzai, you know, show compelling evidence that lifestyle is the way to delay, even prevent, you know, dementia. It's about lifestyle. And, you know, the drug industry really hasn't come up with anything. Now, maybe they've been pursuing completely the wrong route, following this sort of beta amyloid issue. And I think that's clearly, they've been led down the wrong road. But again, I think you always have to have, I certainly do, a degree of cynicism where research is perhaps secondary to the main goal of a pharmaceutical company, is to come out with a very profitable medication. And one has to be cynical about research on drugs. Going back, almost 40 years, when Prozac came out, the Prozac trials were done only on men. Women did not participate in those trials then. Yeah, it was common not to include women. And given that women, 65% of the antidepressant users, so it means they weren't really represented. So they're only on men. The trial was done for only 8 weeks. Well, we now know that people are on these things for decades, okay? So it was only done for 8 weeks. People getting the drug were also given an anti-anxiety drug because there were concerns about suicidal ideas. So it wasn't just a test of one drug, it was a test of Prozac plus something else, right? Next, people were moved between groups, which is actually a total no-no in research. You don't do that. Why they were moved between groups, I don't know, but they were moved between groups.
So were they moved between the Prozac trial and the placebo?
Yes. And finally, a lot of negative data was suppressed and never reviewed. And that was the beginning of SSRIs. And moreover, there really wasn't any compelling theory of whether serotonin had anything to do with depression.
And yet, here we are.
Here we are.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So, you know, when you know that, you have to be cynical about it, and you have to say, this is why research has to be multi-centered and multi-layered. All sorts of different groups, totally unconnected around the world, ideally focused on the research, not other motivation, not to make money, not to be a hero and, you know, create the ultimate cure. Just look at the data. You know, maybe that's asking a lot of human beings who we know can fool us. You know, we can fool ourselves, believe anything that we want. And so that model of science, which is great, and when it works well, but it has some of those intrinsic flaws in it.
Right. So I invite everyone to open up your own medicine chest and see what you've got in there. And just interesting, right? To go, okay, well,
we should always add the rejoinder that please don't, stop taking medications without going to your physician and so forth and so forth. And again, we have to be careful that just because that research was flawed doesn't mean to say in this particular idea that the idea is flawed, right? Right? Just because the research didn't work out or, needed to be sort of heftily manipulated, that means that research may have been suspect, but it doesn't mean that it's true that serotonin reuptake inhibitors actually do help. I know we share the same view about psychoactive medications, that maybe they're useful in the short term, but they don't typically provide the long-term solution to problems. But many people use them, as I say, for decades. And part of the problem is it's really difficult to withdraw from them.
And so what is the... Why is it difficult to withdraw from them?
Actually, one of the things that happens is when you are artificially or pharmacologically, let's say, increasing a transmitter like serotonin, after a while, the brain's natural process of creating serotonin actually slows down because it's been getting all this external stuff. Right.
And so it actually kind of makes you weaker in a way. Then.
In some ways, there's some theory about that when I think that's probably a common experience with people. They come off a medication that is doing something to their brain and transmitters, and it's really tough. It's not just withdrawal. Mm. It's just that even past the withdrawal stage, you might still be feeling lower than you were before, because maybe this has actually changed temporarily or maybe longer term your brain's ability to create what it needs.
Right.
And so again, you know, you need to be very careful about that. But you know, for a lot of these psychoactive medications, you know, Adderall, you know, it's a multi-billion-dollar business. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't know that, but ADD used to be called, and when I was in training, it used to be called minimal brain dysfunction. And it was a kind of general disability about trying to connect dots and attention and stuff like that. But it was the pharmaceutical industry who really pushed to get the name changed to attention deficit disorder, right?
What's in a name?
Big difference, right?
Right.
So, you know, again, you have to look at the realities of what is going on. And this isn't, you know, I think we should be cynical about everything. And so science, when done properly, works. But we're human beings. There's all sorts of other motives, and we need to stay on top of that and understand that and not necessarily get caught up in one view of a problem, mm-hmm. because there surely is more than one view of a problem.
Right. And which is a gift, because then that's how you can change things. Right. So if you're stuck in the one view, all you ever see is the world through that one view thing. And then you find out actually that the there's a shelf life to the one approach fits all sort of thing too. You know, even in your own life, you go, if you're training for something, you know, you lift 20 pounds, you lift 20 pounds, you lift 20 pounds. And then all of a sudden you go, well, this is boring and I need to do something else because nothing's changing here. So you change it to 22 pounds, for example, or you change your whatever exercise because it is, you've plateaued or you've flatlined or whatever. It's not getting you the result that you wanted. And in life, it's like that too. It's like you're interested in learning things, right? It's like, well, I wanted to mm-hmm. learn how to walk, and then I learned how to run, and then I learned mm-hmm. how to cook stuff. And so then I got skilled in this and that, but we're always learning different things. So why is it you think that we get entrenched in this sort of, what's going on neurologically, that we get entrenched in the one size fits all when it comes to the pharmacy stuff?
Yeah, and I think, again, we want to, you know, we'll believe what we want to believe, right? And certainly if you're a researcher who believes in a particular theory and wants to pursue it and has years in that, it's going to be difficult for that person really to say, you know what, this isn't what I thought it was. You know, and it's also difficult then for all these agencies that have been giving out millions and millions of dollars also to turn around and say, yeah, perhaps we got a bit misled. You know, where are you? Are you following this? Why aren't you doing this image checking? Why right. leave it to, you know, the sort of random circumstance, you know? And so, I mean, I think there are questions there. One of the issues has come up about, you know, Karen Ash, who runs the laboratory where Silman Lesney is the guy who's been doing this questionable research. You know, how much did she know about this? How much should she know? And what I've seen is some people in the field saying, well, you know, whether she knew about it or not, one thing she should have done, she should have checked these images mm-hmm. to see how legitimate they were.
So has she come out with any statements since?
No, neither Lesney or Ash, as far as I am aware, have made any comment about this at all, except to say no comment, I think. As of my reading, you know, which is not, you know, fully extensive. It's not like I'm an investigative journalist following this, but what I've seen so far, most of it is no comment.
Right. And we've talked about in previous episodes or, you know, in conversations, we've talked about our inability to apologize when we've done something wrong is our Achilles.
Oh yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's just like, yeah. If you can't apologize, like having that hubris of going, oh man, this was a total fail. Sorry, right. I missed that. Sorry, I dropped the ball. But the apology too is very difficult for people. You have to separate yourself from reality. I'm thinking about the world leaders that I currently watch. that are standing talking, and you go, like, do you even hear yourself? Do you honestly even hear yourself? Like, we're in this right now in Canada where I look at our leader and go, like, how do you even hear what you are saying at all? And do you have any idea what's actually going on here? Because yeah, there's like, so it's a denial of reality. Is that? The denial of reality is like a, when does it become clinical? Like when you go, okay.
Yes, that's true. That's a really good point. At what point can you say this is clinical? You know, that denial is almost psychotic or delusional. You know, and certainly you could point to any number of politicians who say, you know, they really sound delusional.
Huh? Yeah, and it's shocking for the average person. But then when you actually hear that talk or the vacuum of not talk, if not actually apologizing, then regular people think that's actually how you're supposed to act. Here's our leaders. Here's our mentors.
Well, yes, and it's unfortunate.
If they can do that, why can't I?
Yeah, and really what's unfortunate is if you put yourself in a position like running a lab where this sort of thing has come up, do you say nothing? In the current environment, that might probably be the best strategy. But if you're honest and come out and say, you know, I didn't realize this was happening, you know, I apologize, what have you, the danger is, because of the world works, oh, no, I'm not going to give her a grant anymore, which is actually unfortunate, I think. You know, if somebody came out and was totally honest about it, that's somebody who I would give a grant to, right? But, you know, unfortunately, it works this way. Any criticism of anyone, oh, you got to stop supporting them. And that's just not right. It just isn't. Because all you're doing is making it more likely that people aren't going to be authentic and honest. We need to be rewarding people for doing that, not punishing them. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, because we screw up all the time. I know that's a shock, right?
Yeah, no, we do. We all screw up all of the time. And so we need to be aware of that. And you need to be humble enough to be honest and authentic, and also not scared of the backlash. Hey, this is the truth. You deal with it how you like, you know? But I'm telling you the truth. And, you know, that's an amazingly powerful position to be in, you know?
Right. Yes. So if we can push the reset on all of this stuff going forward, I think that that there is these pivot points in culture where if people who were in leadership positions actually stepped up and they showed the courage that it takes to actually go, okay, yeah, made a mistake here, a doozy. It's a doozy. But that's when these culture shifts can happen where people start to be able to confess themselves when they've done stuff that's wrong. But when you see leadership that's in denial, why would you behave any differently? So again, it's like that calling on people to actually be good leaders and to say what's really going on. And with transparency, like it's like tell no lies, right? Mm-hmm. This telling no lies is this ethical piece or trying to tell the truth. Because your truth, again, is your truth in the moment. So these things might change. You know, I'll give an example. In 2009 or 2008, when I went for my genetic testing, I thought this is the most, like, it's important to go for genetic testing. That's how I felt at that time. But I don't feel like that anymore. I think the truth is that once you know, you can't not know. And so... But being able to have to change my mind about things along the way, and for people again not to go, well, you've got a lot of nerve changing your mind about that. I go, well, yeah, because I have insight now. I have more insight and more wisdom about it for myself, right? So you're going to make whatever decision you're going to make. But if you're at the helm of an organization, or that you're responsible for a bunch of people, and to clearly articulate what your thoughts are and where you came up with that is important for the success of your own life and for the success of people who are relying on you and depending on you. You know, so when we go back to the Alzheimer's example, it's like you're hoping everybody forgets. No pun intended, right? It's just like, but I hope everyone forgets about that. that there was this big error. However, back at the ranch, you've got millions of dollars still in flow around that little piece of information. It's kind of like when everyone was told that the brain was hardwired, right? And then all of a sudden you're realizing, oh man, no, it's neuroplastic. Look at all the stuff that's happening. And now what do we do with that? Because you're asking people to change what they do day to day mid stride, you know? So if all of your research was based on this paper, then what did you do the next day when you found out that that wasn't, when it wasn't true? So what did people actually do, Howard? Was there scrambling, do you think, like in the labs? Like what did, or did people just pick up another, you know, pipette? Like, what do you do?
And it's going to be really interesting to see, because this has been the focus, you know, in Alzheimer's research, especially on the physical / pharmacological side. This has been almost the total focus, you know, the amyloid mafia. And, you know, again, as you said earlier, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It doesn't mean that this doesn't have a role, but it seems like we've been going down the wrong pathway here. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it is important, and I'm sure there are people around the world doing other research on different types of proteins and plaque and all of that. And maybe that will get better coverage now that there's suspicion been thrown on this amyloid notion.
Right.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things, and you know, we're talking about hard science. When you look at social sciences and psychological research, you know, there's a lot of criticism, and justifiably so, about a lot of social psychology and psychology research. You know, the problem is, just think about this, the problem is, one of them, you can't control all the variables you know, let alone all the variables you don't know. So it's a very, very limited view of a topic, right? And you could take almost any social psychological paper and pick holes in it. You know, oh yeah, we did a study which looked at, you know, people's eating habits over the last and related to this. Okay, first question, are people reliable in telling you about their eating habits? Do they even know what their eating habits are? Are they going to tell you? You know, so you start off right there. How reliable is this data? We don't know, right? And are those people who aren't eating well, you know, what other things are they not doing? You know, they're not exercising. They're not sleeping right. They don't have, you know, good stress management. They're more under. So what are the variables that are important? Just because you looked at food,
what else is going on?
What else is going on? And what's the direction? You know, as human beings, we want to always connect things. Two things happen together. Oh, they're somehow not only related, but causally related in one direction. No, they may not be related at all. They may not be causally related. And you may be looking at the wrong direction, right? So, you know, studies, for example, oh, people who live near high traffic areas, you know, tend to have, you know, worse health. Well, people who live there tend to be lower SES, who have poor health anyway. So is it really to do with the traffic, or is it to do with all these other factors? And to really get to the bottom of that, you'd have to do almost endless experiments, right, controlling for all these variables.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And the question then becomes, why do we need all these studies? Is also a question, right? Why do you need a study about the people who are living by the traffic? Like, why are we doing that? What is the end game? Are you just curious? Or are you trying to, what are you trying to solve there with that information?
Yeah. Well, I think there's value. You know, if you say, look, people living near, you know, high traffic areas do have poorer health. Okay. So now we dig down. So, you know, somebody does some research on socioeconomic status, somebody does something on nutrition, and gradually you sculpt a much, you know, as you dig down, you get more questions, but gradually the picture does begin to evolve. But it's really difficult to get it in one study, which is why you need numerous studies by various independent agencies. Mm-hmm. That's how science is meant to work. And when it does, hey, yeah, that's great. But a lot of the time it doesn't work like that.
Right. So with that, I am going to drill down on that example a bit, because again, I asked myself, who came up with the idea for this particular study and why are you doing it? Like, what's the point of doing that particular thing? Is it to help people? Is it to change the traffic flow? Like, what is it that what is it you're trying to achieve out of this study, scientists?
Right. And again, I'm not sure of the derivation and the origin of the studies on environmental impact, et cetera, of traffic. But typically it has evolved, you know, someone at some point in time had a theory and a little bit of evidence that, boy, you know, more traffic creates all this exhaust, and that's probably not healthy. And, you know, I really believe that, you know, if you're exposed to traffic fumes, you're going to be unhealthier. And then somebody takes that and builds on it, you know?
Right.
And so that's typically how it works. It builds on previous ideas. How valuable those previous ideas were is questionable a lot of the time, but it makes sense. It flows from a concept.
Right, right. Very good. Okay, so when we're talking about ongoing the psychosocial studies, what do you think are the big ones that are right now either helpful or questionable? Is there anything that that when you're talking in your in the scientific community, are there studies that are happening right now that helpful, hurtful, or questionable?
Well, I think here's the thing that I would suggest for people who are interested in this. If I did a study and come out and say, hey, my study showed that when you got up first thing in the morning and you smiled, you were much less likely to be depressed during the day. Okay? And I come out with that. You should look at that with a serious grain of salt. You should look at, first of all, why would that be? You know, why is that? Why does that make any sense? Does it pass a sort of common sense test? Secondly, even if it were true, what all sorts of other reasons could be? I mean, people who are happier probably naturally do smile first thing in the day, you know. Or, you know, you could be cynical about it. As W.C. Fields said, first thing you do when you get up in the morning is smile and get it over with for the day. So, and if this study just stands out apart and there really isn't any other evidence about it, then you really need to take that with a grain of salt. Because science isn't about one study. It's about multitude of studies coming to similar conclusions on a topic. That's what it's about. And one of the things that's happened, over the years is it's become sort of more fashionable and maybe even profitable for an individual researcher or a group of people to set up their own little area of interest and capture the headlines, but no one else is doing the research on that. There's no justification for it. There's no, you know, and so one research study on its own, you know, or even two, you need many.
Yeah. Yeah. Good, great point. And the reason I wanted to bring that up is because a lot of times people will just cite one thing and then you go, okay, well, what about the rest of it? Because there's a lot more to this than just meets the eye superficially or on the surface. So it is important to, you know, dive into things and to talk to people. You know, I think that that's been a big, you know, a non-starter, even more so nowadays, that people don't want to talk about their experiences with anything because they're afraid of getting you know, whatever, blackballed or ignored or vilified or like any of that stuff. So the right. point of science was supposed to be curious. What's our curiosity and how can we talk about the curious nature of us and our thoughts and thinking if we're going to be shooting each other down every time we say something out loud?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, all of us need to be open-minded about that, you know, even on this topic. Again, as I was saying, well, this certainly sheds light on some of these key question marks, red flags, as Matthew Schrag says, about these studies. But it doesn't, we can't jump to the conclusion, therefore, amyloid beta's got nothing to do with dementia. That would be going ridiculously far in the other direction. We've obviously been focusing on this, you know, too narrow. We need to look at other options and bigger picture. And I think that's always true in science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love it. I think that is our own, we talk about wellness within and people, you know, taking back their psychological health or thinking about the way that they think, you know, so they can question the quality of their own life. And that not just putting it in the hands of scientists and whatever is the, you know, whatever the study of the day or the information of the day, is that checking internally and going, well, how do I feel? Because part of the reason why we read all those studies or research is we're trying to help ourselves or other people. That's right. the main thing. As a non-scientist or as a person who's doing whatever else they're doing in their life, you read studies and you're curious about those things. Why? Why do you care about it?
Mm-hmm.
So typically it's because you're trying to change something
right.
in your own life.
Yeah, try to improve a situation for, you know, in this case, millions of people, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yes. Look at your motives.
Yes, look at your motives and decide on your ethics, as always, right? That's the important thing. So, Howard, who have you had recently on as a guest that if people are going to come over to your podcast, I think, therefore, I am wrong. Now, who can
actually,
they see?
Actually, you got the title of my book. My podcast is called How Not to Think.
Oh, sorry. How Not to Think. How Not to Think. So what? And don't think like that. Write that down. Whoops, I made a mistake. So How Not to Think. Who's a guest that people would like to tune into that you have upcoming that you'd like to do a little promo for?
Well, I've had lots of great guests. One, I will pick out one, since we are talking about sort of science and how we work, I did a show last fall, I think, with a scientist called John Leaf. Have you had him on yet?
I have not.
No, and I referred him to you. And he, you know, his book, The Secret Language of Cells, was mind blowing even to me. And it's an awesome book. He's really, really interesting guy with a lot of valuable things to say about how our mind-body works, the relationship between conscious and subconscious, and this incredibly complex trillions of cells that are going on that are really driving a lot of our behavior. And, you know, just following on this whole concept of science and, you know, our bodies and our minds, that would definitely be one I would recommend. John Leaf, Leeff. But, you know, most of the shows are good. They are, well, let me say all of the shows are good. And they are, you know, designed to get people thinking differently about the topics we're talking about.
Right. Love it. And then also, as we take the show, can you just tell us a little bit, or the listeners a little bit, about your book also? I think it's timely because, again, we're talking about redemption, you know, right. So we haven't talked about that on this show a whole lot, but what is the name of your book? And
right. So I have another book called Falling to Grace, The Art and Science of Redemption. You know, which is really about ethics and morality and is about my own story and what I learned when I put myself rather stupidly in a difficult situation that changed my life, what seemingly looked like for the worse, but really for the better. Wouldn't have met you, Leah, for one thing. So Falling to Grace, the Art and Science of Redemption. And that book, in my experience, shows that authenticity and honesty is unbelievably powerful. And so many of us at different levels, whether we're talking about politicians or even at an individual level, are so scared and paranoid of saying, oh, I screwed up there. I made a mistake. But when you do, it's amazing how, you'll get some flack, but you'll also get a lot of praise.
Yeah, and some freedom. So,
yes, absolutely.
Freedom. Freedom. So, yeah. Dr. Howard Rankin, thank you so much for being my guest once again and talking about this difficult and complex subject, and for also sharing just the cool work that you're doing and the books that you've written to help people to change their lives. Everyone, I want to invite you all to love yourselves, love each other, mind your minds. That's all for us. Bye for now. Thanks, Howard.
Thank you for being a part of our program today. Master Your Life is a presentation of Leah Mattinson Enterprises, Inc. Join us next time on Master Your Life, helping you to discover the very best of you.